This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. The Berlin Wall fell in 1989 in a giddy international party. The Cold War was over. The world toasted a new era of peace. Instead, the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union unleashed centuries-old ethnic hatreds and started new wars. The world became a more dangerous place. Now, says historian John Lewis Gaddis, that period of false hope has ended for good with the destruction of another symbolic structure, the World Trade Center. This hour, we are looking at the new Cold War in the light of the old and asking, does the Cold War have lessons to teach the U.S. in the new war on terrorism? First, President Bush in China, his first trip abroad since September 11th. The president will address the economic summit, but free trade isn't topic number one. Robert Marquand is a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He is following President Bush's visit in Shanghai. Hello, Robert Marquand.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. This is Mr. Bush's first trip to China as president and his first trip abroad since the attack. How is he and the war on terrorism being received?
Well, you know, coming here to Shanghai, the Chinese had hoped pretty much that the Shanghai Economic Summit, something they've put a lot of interest and invested a lot of time and capital in over the past two or three years, this event, 21 countries, was going to be basically China's economic coming out party. The Chinese have spent a great deal of time on Shanghai. They were going to showcase the high-tech skyline here. They were going to quietly bask in their 7% economic growth rate, and it's turned into an anti-terrorism summit, a kind of war party on wheels. They've come into Shanghai, and terrorism has dominated the agenda here. And the president meets with President Jiang Zemin of China for the first time today. And the Chinese have valiantly tried to keep economics in a separate category from the anti-terrorism agenda of the United States, but it really hasn't worked out very well. It's terrorism is the number one subject here.
What are the Chinese saying about the war on terrorism?
Well, they've been quietly cautious, and they've been also cautiously supportive of the U.S. position. They've got their own interests. They've got a Uyghur Muslim population in western China that they've actually started a crackdown on in the past couple weeks. So they want the United States to kind of turn away from too much examination of how that operation is going. The United States is probably going to lift some sanctions and give some military hardware for Black Hawk helicopters that the Chinese purchased in the 1980s. And the Chinese also want the United States to soften its position on Taiwan. This seems to be another issue as well.
Is there quite a sort of understood quid pro quo there? We'll endorse your war on terrorism if you do something for us on Taiwan and with helicopters and so on?
Well, that's what everyone's waiting to see, what comes out of this. It's a little hard to tell whether the Chinese are actually going to get the Bush administration, which has been resolutely pro-Taiwan, to change its position is really unclear. Certainly in its heart, the administration wants to back the independent democratic state of Taiwan. And the Chinese, of course, it's a central issue for them. And I think they would just like to see the United States reaffirm the one China policy in a harder way than it has before.
Mm-hmm. Secretary of State Colin Powell did some of the advance work for the president, meeting with foreign and trade ministers. What did he accomplish?
Well, he was trying to set up the trip as what I think the administration is trying to do, in light of the way the Chinese have hoped that this would be a showcase on the economy, is the Powell and the Bush advance team both have tried to say, look, being for against terrorism is good for the economy. It's good for the economy of the region. The region has been having a lot of trouble, with the exception of China. The East Asia region has been in a bit of a tailspin. Consumer confidence is way down, and a lot of there was a problem before September 11, and since September 11, there's been, despite the fact that Japan and Singapore and some of the other regional economies have there's been a new round of government spending and investment and tax breaks, but nonetheless it hasn't checked the fall of the economy here. So the administration has been saying we need to get a coalition together, and but the hope is that will create a momentum, political momentum, mm-hmm. to also do the kind of economic liberalization that the APEC summit was designed to accomplish.
And this summit has begun or instituted or given a political declaration about terrorism, hasn't it?
That's the first time that the talking shop like the APEC meeting has ever come out with a strong political statement. That's true. Mm-hmm. What we're hearing, what Powell said he heard from the various. Yes.
I'm afraid I've got to go, but thank you very much. Really appreciate your helping us out. Thank you.
Glad to. You bet.
Robert Marquand is covering President Bush's China visit for the Christian Science Monitor. We're talking this hour about the Cold War and its lessons for this new crisis. Are you missing the comparative rationality of the Cold War? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us is John Lewis Gaddis, a historian from Yale University and the author of numerous books about the Cold War. And with us in the studio is tonight's news analyst, Joan Vinaki, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here.
Welcome. John, let's start with you. Just to orient our discussion, can you lay out the terms of the analogy between the Cold War and what began on September 11th, and maybe also say where the analogy breaks down?
Sure. Let's start, Jack, with where the analogies break down, because the Cold War was something that evolved gradually. It was not like World War II, which started for us with Pearl Harbor and a surprise attack, which really was quite similar to what happened on September 11th. So it seems to me that's the point of dissimilarity, which is the suddenness with which we were thrust into this new and unexpected era. But I think that having happened, probably we can draw more useful analogies from the Cold War period than we can from World War II, where obviously we fought a very different kind of war and confronted a different kind of adversary. And perhaps also from the post-Cold War period, when we perceived ourselves as being really without a coherent adversary, unpleasant though that period was. So I think the Cold War in that sense perhaps can give us some analogies. It was a long, sustained struggle against an enemy who was sometimes clear and sometimes not so clear.
The enemy was clear ideologically. It had a kind
the enemy,
of excuse me.
Yeah, the enemy was clear in the sense that it was the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. but it's worth remembering that through much of the Cold War, we defined the enemy much more broadly than that. It mm-hmm. was communism everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we saw communism in that period almost in the way that we see terrorism today. We saw it as a sinister, subtle force operating behind the scenes, crossing international boundaries, posing domestic security issues for us, not so much terrorism, but the danger of espionage. So for a while, the late 1940s, the 1950s, we tended to look at international communism in some of the same ways that we see terrorism today.
The enemy within. I remember that phrase from a J. Edgar Hoover book, I think.
Absolutely.
And there was much concentration on that enemy and much really magnification of him, as it turned out. Looking back, what was the Cold War about? President Bush has defined the war on terrorism as one between freedom and fear, but what was the Cold War about?
I think ultimately the Cold War was about something similar. It was about the difference between democracy and authoritarianism. In that sense, it was a continuation of the war that we waged against the authoritarians of World War II. I think ultimately we prevailed in the Cold War because the model that we had to offer wound up being more attractive to the rest of the world than the authoritarian model. There was always something worse out there than we were. And the result of that was that we were allowed a fair amount of tolerance, I think, in the world in building coalitions, in leading coalitions. We managed somehow, because of the existence of something worse out there, to lead without at the same time appearing to be as arrogant or as dominating as somehow we have come across being in the post-Cold War period, when there really was not something worse out there.
And the idea of containment was not really wholly a military idea, was it? It was an idea that we would that the Soviets would sort of die of their own contradictions in the end.
Absolutely. We hear a lot, Jack, right now about asymmetrical warfare, and the point has been made that terrorism is a form of asymmetrical warfare. But so too was containment. What we confronted was an ideological slash military threat in Europe. And we countered it with primarily economic and political means. The idea was to rebuild European self-confidence through decisions like the Marshall Plan to make those countries again prosperous, which created the basis for prosperity and ultimately a situation in which communism would not really have that much appeal.
Hmm. Joan Bernanke, give us a word picture of what life was like here in the Cold War, and how is it different today?
Well, I guess I sit here as the average person who is, you know, trying or struggling to put this in some kind of familiar context. And for the baby boomer, you know, the memories of the Cold War are the memories of childhood, actually, when, you know, you could remember, you know, duck and cover sitting under a, you know, a wooden desk in a classroom, or the memories of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you had a sense as a child of something very serious and grave happening, but of people that seemed to be in command and in control. And, you know, to the average person, I mean, the enemy was communism and the communists, and it was scary, but there was a sense that we were prepared for it, whether it was, you know, maybe it was a false sense of security, but bomb shelters, you know, stockpiling food or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you fast forward, you know, from that kind of feeling of threat, but that it was a controlled threat, to what we have today, you know, suddenly we're confronting an enemy that we not only don't know who they are or where they are, but exactly, you know, how to deal with them.
Hmm. John, that sort of answers to my memory of the Cold War, this sort of latent fear, but at the same time, a bounded fear.
I think that's right, Jack. The Cold War certainly created a sense of danger, and I think I certainly remember, as Joan does, living through these really quite desperate periods. But that danger was always external. The danger was the danger of missiles coming in. The danger at an earlier point was the danger of spies being run from outside. But there was never a sense in the Cold War that Americans, as they went about their daily business, just as they traveled or tried to work, were in danger in the same way that this new threat has made us feel that we are.
There was a kind of rationality in that sense to the Cold War, wasn't there?
There was indeed. We confronted an adversary that we came to understand, and we came in time, not at the beginning, but in time, to speak the same language in the sense that we were brought together by a common danger. As we became more and more aware of the danger of thermonuclear weapons and what a war between us and the Soviets would actually mean, we became more cooperative with one another. This cooled the conflict over a long period of time. And so we wound up with a kind of convergent rationality, even though that was certainly not there at the beginning.
And some people, of course, at the height of the Cold War were talking about convergent economic systems. That didn't come to pass.
That never did come to pass. And, of course, ultimately what did end the Soviet Union was the collapse of its economic system, precisely the fact that it did not converge with what was becoming the dominant system in the rest of the world.
It couldn't catch up, and it certainly couldn't catch up with the American defense budget. I remember Castor Weinberger saying, President Reagan's defense secretary, we would deter the Soviets with dollars. Is the post-Cold War era over? What will define this new world order? What lessons can we draw from the post-Cold War era to inform this new era? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join an online discussion. Do you feel safer now than you did during the Cold War? Log on at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking about the new Cold War this hour in the wake of September 11th. The first Cold War was about communism. It inflamed the rhetoric of world leaders from Churchill to Reagan.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe.
That false philosophy is communism. Our allies are the millions who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Steadfast in our faith in the Almighty, we will advance toward a world where man's freedom is secure. To that end, we will devote our strength, our resources, and our firmness of resolve. With God's help, the future of mankind will be assured in a world of justice, harmony, and peace.
You are seeing today an all-out attempt to marshal the forces of the opposition, using not merely the communists, but the fellow travelers, the deluded liberals, the eggheads, and some of my good friends in both the Democrat and Republican Party, who can become heroes overnight in the eyes of the left-wing press if they will join with the jackal pack. Now, what you will find is the all-out attempt to try and curb the powers of the investigating committee.
And this increase in communication will teach us some things, and it will teach you some things, too. Because, after all, you don't know everything.
If I don't know everything, then I would say that you know absolutely nothing about communism. Nothing except fear of it.
And deception. And our history, unlike that of the Soviets since the end of World War II, demonstrates that we have no desire to dominate or conquer any other nation or impose our system upon its people. Nevertheless, American citizens have become adjusted to living daily on the bullseye of Soviet missiles located inside the USSR or in submarines. In that sense, missiles in Cuba add to an already clear and present danger.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia.
That gift of freedom is actually the birthright of all humanity. And that's why, as I stood there, I urged the Soviet leader, Mr. Gorbachev, to send a new signal of openness to the world by tearing down that wall.
Those were the voices of Winston Churchill, President Harry Truman, Senator Joseph McCarthy, Vice President Richard Nixon, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, Presidents John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan. This hour, we're talking about the end of the post-Cold War era and how it's shaping the war on terrorism. What do you make of the New World Disorder, and do you have a name for it? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. We're here with Cold War historian John Gaddis of Yale University and tonight's news analyst, Boston Globe columnist Joan Vernocchi. John, before we turn to the post-Cold War period and its lessons, what are the lessons of the Cold War for our current period?
Well, I think there's several possible lessons of the Cold War, Jack. One really might well be to come back to the idea of containment, because I think the concept is valid, even though the target this time is different. Focusing on this objective, focusing it on it as a long-term proposition, understanding that this is an activity that has got to be carried out on a lot of different fronts, and understanding that results won't come immediately. I think this is one thing that might be useful for us. But a lot of people don't realize that one of the aspects of containment that made it work was that we were particularly good at exploiting the vulnerabilities of our adversary. It was not just a matter of the Soviet model not being as attractive as our own model, but it was also a matter of the fractures that developed within the Soviet coalition. The defection of Tito in Yugoslavia, for example, in 1948, the break with China, which occurred at the end of the 1950s. And we were more sensitive to these developments, historians have discovered, than often appeared to be the case at the time. We understood that one of the problems with an authoritarian movement is that rivals tend to develop within it, and the alliance does not hold together sometimes as well as it might within a democratic system. So I think one of the things that we ought to be thinking about right now, even as we try to define the adversary in this new situation, is to think about the wedges that we might be able to drive between that adversary and others who might be trying to help them. And, of course, the Bush administration has already begun to raise this possibility with what is coming to be called the Bush Doctrine, which is the idea that states that sanction or support or sustain terrorism will be treated as terrorists. But, of course, the obvious intent of that is to try to move those states away from doing that. And that's an example of trying to exploit the potential fissures that may lie within this movement.
I wonder if I could just break in with question. In the old Cold War, the enemy was the evil empire. President Bush has defined this war against the evil doers. That seems to me like, you know, sort of a key difference, an empire versus unknown individuals or, you know, assorted individuals. How do you contain evildoers as individuals? And in a piece that you wrote for The Atlantic Monthly a couple of years ago, you talked about the difference in the Cold War where the participants believed in what you called, you know, rational choice scenarios, where they were playing a deadly game, but they didn't want to blow up the world and destroy everybody in the course of it. If we're dealing with people who are now believers in irrational choice scenarios, I mean, you know, how do you deal with that new enemy?
I think you start with the word that you used, evil. This really gets at the center of it. And these people are truly evil, and what they did was truly evil. Nothing could have justified it. That is an immense source of strength for the United States and for other states, indeed for a very broad range of states who are now forming a coalition to counter this evil. Because this is a movement really ultimately that is directed not just against the United States and not just against infidels, as Osama bin Laden would define everybody who doesn't follow his beliefs. But it really ultimately is a movement that's directed against states, period, against state authority. It is subversive of state authority in general. And once you begin to take on that, once you begin to take on states, you're taking on quite a lot. You're really trying to reverse the tides of history that have been flowing for more than 500 years. States have a reason for existence, and the reason has a lot to do with protecting us against anarchy, against violence, against the kind of world that Osama bin Laden would like to create. And just by the fact of who he is and what he's doing, he is generating a coalition that is in some ways far grander and much wider and potentially deeper than what we had during the Cold War. So evil has a lot to do with it. Evil is at the center of it. But the means to counter evil are certainly there.
Hmm. Let's take a call from Craig. Hello. Craig, welcome.
Hi. Comment I want to make is that I think the discussion on the Cold War is important, but I think we're not talking about the right war. And we need to be discussing the First World War, because that's where these problems originated.
World War I.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Can you lay that out for us briefly?
Well, actually, as much as I don't want to have to say this, the person who laid that out was Omar bin Laden in his videotape. When he talked about 80 years of oppression, I knew immediately what he was referring to.
Hmm.
And he was referring to the League of Nations imposing mandates over the Arab peoples and carving up the Middle East between the French and the British.
Hmm. He was talking about that sort of imperialism,
right.
In short. Yeah.
And the thought that I've had, and to be honest, it's actually a thought that I had originally on the day that NATO started the air campaign against Kosovo. I keep asking myself, why is the United States constantly having to try to clean up the messes that the imperial powers made?
Mm, good question.
And what needs to change, I think, and I'm generalizing, but
sure.
In our policies is that we got to realize our policies have to be dictated based upon what America really is and what our values are, not on trying to, you know, fix the world because the imperial powers made so many mistakes.
Well, thank you for that question. John Gaddis, what about that, the World War I as the source of our troubles theory?
Well, you can make this case, but you could also make the case that a lot of other history that preceded World War I and a lot of other history that followed World War I also contributed to this situation. So simply singling out World War I, I think, does not completely answer the question. The imperial powers in that part of the world have been gone for quite a long time. And the same is true of the Balkans as well, if you think about the Ottoman Empire as the imperial power. And a lot has happened since then. I think the roots of this crisis, the roots of this rage and dissatisfaction are much more immediate than those more distant situations. They can't be disassociated from that. No historian would claim that. No historian would disassociate anything from anything that happened in the past. But as a matter of thinking through the current situation and as a matter of thinking about our response, I think we have to acknowledge that there are more recent causes of this situation than World War I.
What would they be? I mean, how would you understand those?
I think they would lie in several different directions. One has to say, first of all, that it's hard to know what goes through the mind of an Osama bin Laden. But what we do know is that whatever it is that's going through his mind is generating a substantial amount of resonance elsewhere in the Middle East. He is by no means alone in his feelings, though he may be alone. We hope he's alone in terms of his movement and his means. So, yes, there is rage in the Middle East, but I think it comes from several different sources. It seems to me, first of all, from the failure of the states in that region to do more to improve the lives of their own people. Those states have been independent, free of imperialism for a long time, half a century in most cases, if not longer. Many of those states are extraordinarily wealthy, not all, but many. The retention of authoritarian regimes in those states, not necessarily because the United States has caused this to happen, but because the regimes themselves have not been able to progress and treat their people with greater respect, I think is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Other parts of the problem certainly do relate to policies that the United States has followed. Support for Israel,
sure.
Certainly being one of these. Of
sanctions.
Course. Sanctions, yes, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
We have to remember how we got into those policies in the first place, and particularly, I think, with respect to the Gulf War, with respect to Kosovo, with respect to Bosnia, it's interesting to think of how many of our interventions in this part of the world actually have been in defense of Muslims.
Including Somalia.
Yes, indeed. Sure.
Yeah.
Just to say that the Americans are invariably anti-Muslim doesn't make a lot of sense, it seems to me. I think there are more things going on here than just anti-Americanism.
Mm. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joan.
I was just going to hone in on the Israel thing for a moment. If this is about Israel and Palestine, is there a way to, you know, end this war without somehow, you know, changing American policies?
I am not sure. I think that's going to be one of the major questions that we're going to have to confront. There's no question, it seems to me, that our policy with regard to Israel and the Palestinians has tilted toward Israel over the years. We have tried to achieve a balance, but the balance has been one that has benefited Israel over a considerable period of time. I think in the long run, if we are going to achieve a settlement, we are going to have to push for more rights for the Palestinians. The Bush administration has already moved in that direction by indicating that it's sympathetic to the idea of a Palestinian state. I think this means resisting harder than we have resisted Israeli settlement policy. Mm. But, of course, it also means trying to put pressure on the Palestinians to lessen the kind of terror that we continue to see examples of.
Even in today's state. So, let's take a call for a minute, John. Russ is on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi. I thought it was a very interesting point that during the Cold War, we were against the forces of authoritarianism. But I think if you look at it from the point of view of the people in the Middle East, we've flipped, and we are now supporting authoritarianism. Most of the governments in the Arab Peninsula are either dictators or royal families who are sort of benevolent kings. But any way you slice it, it's not a free society anywhere in the Arab Peninsula. And if you think about the only alternative that many of these youths have, and most of the population there is under the age of 25, it's really the only other institution, and that's the mosque. And therefore, I think Muslim fundamentalism is seen as not as fear, as Bush would say, it's sort of freedom against fear. I think rather the mosque and fundamentalism is the only outlet for people who want freedom. And I think freedom is kind of a basic human desire, and I think that by trying to prevent the rise of fundamentalism, in a way, we are preventing freedom. We're against freedom. And, in fact, we're very tight with the royal families we saved in the Iraq war and all the other regimes that are very authoritarianism in the Arab Peninsula.
So we've reversed ourselves from the Cold War. Then we were against authoritarian regimes. Now we're helping them. John, what about that proposition? There's some truth there.
Well, some truth, but at the same time, not too much, because while the Cold War was about the distinction between freedom and authoritarianism, in the interests of trying to contain Soviet authoritarianism, we aligned ourselves with a lot of authoritarians who happened to be on our side. There were a lot of them in Latin America. There were a lot of them in Southeast Asia. There were a lot of them in the Middle East, and some of them are the countries that we are still allied with. When you're in this kind of a struggle, you get all the help that you can get. You try to form a broad coalition. And sometimes that means compromising your own values in order to do so. We sometimes think that that's abhorrent. We sometimes think that we shouldn't do that. But we need to remember that it has a long history. We need to remember what we did in World War II. We fought World War II alongside Stalin's Russia. We compromised our values in order to defeat what we regarded as a greater danger, Nazi Germany.
And now we're having to sidle up to some pretty...
These kinds of compromises come with the territory in these situations, it seems to me.
Is the post-Cold War era, what will define the new world order? What lessons can we draw from that period to inform this new time? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.
APC.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're looking at the war on terrorism in the shadow of the Cold War. Are our leaders stuck in Cold War I thinking as they tackle the challenges of Cold War II? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Tom is on the line. Hello.
Hi. I didn't hear all of your comments, so I'm coming in a little bit late. But, you know, my thought is that, you know, in some ways, our foreign policy, when we were dealing with the Cold War, we could afford to look at things very simply. You know, we had the Soviets on one side and their sphere of influence, you know, with obviously the caveat of the communist China. And then on the other side, we were the good guys. And when, you know, the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet system collapsed, we somehow thought that we could continue to look at things in a very simple way in terms of looking at the globe. And I think, you know, this sort of good versus evil, you know, us versus them approach to foreign policy is something that is too simplistic, and it doesn't really enable us to, in a proactive way, address problems such as what's happened recently. And I think we have to look at, we have to have a kind of a coherent code of foreign policy strategy, maybe with a kind of ethical moral compass at the top. But we have to look at regional conflicts and try to anticipate these problems before they become, you know, really ugly sores and drag us in more deeply than we want to be. I mean, I think a lot of the warning signs for, you know, what has happened in the former Yugoslavia and what has happened in obviously in Afghanistan and what has happened in other parts of the world. I mean, you could argue that Indonesia is a very dangerous area, are things that with a more far-sighted, alert foreign policy strategy, we could maybe have anticipated and sort of, removed the major problem before it got really bad. I think we're reacting rather than being proactive.
Okay.
A lot of the world is very new.
I think we have that point. Thank you. Thank you very much, Tom. Joan, how about that? We're reacting, and we're also stuck in a sort of moralistic, Manichaean good versus evil.
Well, the good versus evil thing is obviously very simplistic, but I think it got its resonance from the implicit feeling that we were superior and untouchable. So not just that we were good, but that that nobody would ever attack American soil, and that, you know, that sort
invulnerable.
Of that we were invulnerable. And once the Berlin Wall fell, I mean, we sort of entered this kind of age of not just superiority but indifference to what was going on outside beyond our borders.
Mm. John, what about that period, the 12 years of the post-Cold War era that seemed to have ended? Can you see some coherence in that now? And if the United States had those 12 years to run over again, what do you think it would have done differently?
Well, I don't see as much coherence, Jack, as I wish there had been. It seems to me that it's pretty clear that if we had it to run over again, we wouldn't do it in just the same way. I think the problem was not so much that we abandoned our moral sense in this period. It may actually be that we emphasized it a little too strongly. It seems to me that one of the things that historians will say of the post-Cold War era, the 12 years from 1989 to 2001, is that we did quite a lot on behalf of justice. We admitted countries like Czechoslovakia and Poland and Hungary to the NATO alliance because of the injustices that had been committed against them. We went to war against the Serbs really twice because of the injustices that they were committing against the Bosnians and the Kosovars. We did much the same thing in Kuwait. It seems to me that there was more of a premium, perhaps, on justice during this period than we saw during the Cold War. But I think we sacrificed something as we did this. I think in the process of doing this, we neglected the relationship among the great powers. We expanded NATO against the objections of the Russians. Both the Russians and the Chinese had grave reservations about what we were doing in Kosovo because we were interfering in the internal affairs of a sovereign state without United Nations authorization. They worried about that precedent for their own minorities. So I think one thing we didn't do enough of in the post-Cold War era was to balance that concern with justice, with a concern for order and stability. I think you have to do both things. And the path to order and stability, as we're discovering now, comes with building these alignments with the great powers like China, where President Bush is today, to try to maintain a certain stability in the world. So I think we lost sight of that more than we really did our moral vision.
Do you think that that's because as a society a culture, Americans are we're more reactive than proactive, that as long as everything seems to be going along on an even keel and not affecting us personally, that we're kind of willing to let the status quo exist?
Well, not completely. It seems to me that we've always, at least in the 20th century, and certainly in the last half of the 20th century, been pretty active in the world. And some of that has been initiating action and some of it has been reacting. And it's a little hard to sort that out. I think that what we did do in the post-Cold War era was to lose the sense of coherence that danger created for us during the Cold War period. That's too bad. We ought to be able to find a path to coherence without there being a clear and present danger out there. Many of us have been concerned as we try to teach subjects like grand strategy as to how we could try to build the basis for that. But it's now become academic in two different senses of the word, in the sense that we are now back to a very clear and very present danger. And that is going to force on us, it has already forced on us with the dramatic changes that we've seen in the Bush administration's foreign policy just in the last month, a new kind of coherence that will, I think, resemble some of the coherence that we achieved during the Cold War.
Is it too simplistic to just say, you know, we let down our guard?
We did let down our guard in one sense, in the sense that we defined national security in terms of threats coming from overseas. The whole concept of national security, as it goes back to the early days of the Cold War and even to World War II, was premised on the assumption that the threats were actually international, the threats were actually external to us, and we simply assumed domestic security, domestic safety, with good reason. We had no particular reason to worry about that, even at the height of World War II. We didn't really confront any terrorist movements operating within this country, and the same was true of the Cold War. What's new about this situation is that this assumption of free domestic security, this assumption that national security always involves threats that are international, that's what's changed, and that really is a dramatic change in the American situation. It changes the American character, even from what it has been really for 150 years or so, when going back to the last time that we had to worry about threats on our own homeland, which some historians would say was 1814, when the British invaded Washington and burned the White House and the Capitol. And it's very strange that the fourth airplane, the one that crashed, may well have had one of those buildings as its target.
Let's take a call from Tamara. Tamara, hello.
Hi.
Could you be brief, please? I'm afraid we don't have much time, but we'd like to take your call.
Okay. I'd like to tell you that I think that Americans have been fooled during Cold War with Russia. I am a Russian immigrant, and now they've been taken for a ride same way with this war with Palestinians and Arabs. And all societies which are not free, which do not have free press, they can fool the world. They can tell things like in Orwell, which do not really exist. For example, before World War II, Palestinians Israeli were called Palestinians. And Palestinians, the Arabs were not really living in that area before 1840.
Mm. We don't want to go back into the mist of time, but...
No, I just think that they do not have freedom of press. They don't know how to... they don't have freedom to teach their children, and they fool everybody.
Yes, yes.
Same thing as like with Russia.
Okay, well, thank you. It's hard, John, to do business with regimes that are sort of fundamentally illegitimate in some way. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, it is, yes. There's a lack of responsibility there, obviously, in a regime that is not illegitimate. Obviously, one prefers to deal with democratic regimes, and certainly one of the most encouraging things about Russia today is the extent to which it has moved in that direction. Not perfectly, not to the same extent as our standards, but there is much more than there was, you know, 15 years ago, a free press in Russia today. And I think as a consequence, we're more comfortable than we might have been in the past at having Russia as an ally. I think also in the long run, there probably is a vulnerability. There probably is an instability that's associated with this kind of illegitimacy. And in a way, that's what bin Laden and his forces today are exploiting, because they are making the argument that many of the authoritarian Middle Eastern regimes are illegitimate. And that surely is one of the things that we have to think about, is how we can align ourselves with those regimes and at the same time try to transform those regimes so that we convince them that it's in their own interests to gain the legitimacy that they don't have.
Thank you. Thank you, John Gaddis and Joan Vernocchi. John Gaddis is the Robert A. Lovett Professor of History at Yale University and the author of numerous books on the Cold War. His latest is Now We Know, Rethinking Cold War History. Our guest news analyst, Joan Vernocchi, is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. The New York Systems Restaurant is a Rhode Island institution. This afternoon, customer John Puccico spoke about where he was when he first heard about the attacks in New York and how his life has changed since.
It was kind of crazy. Like, I was on my way to the doctor's office, and I opened the door, and people were sitting there watching TV, and I just thought it was some old movie or something. I didn't even realize what it was, and nobody was saying nothing. Everybody was just horrified, I guess, just staring at the TV, about four or five people, and then they started talking. I realized that that had happened, so we just talked about it, and it just went on and on. I think people are getting a little, a little more mellow, thinking about things they're doing. And I think people are trying to become even better Christians and that type of thing. And they're getting closer to their make or their beliefs. I think it has taught us, you know, that we're all in this together. I think that everybody knows that people just think they're going to live long lives and this and that, and they're worrying so much about their health and security and financial. And I think people are going to start to, you know, they're going to start to realize that we're here and now, enjoy life. And I think people are starting to have better relationships with each other and getting stronger, and even in the workplace and everything. I think people are just realizing that, hey, this is a wake-up call for us. I have a friend that talked to me about going to church more, and then since this happened, I kind of on my own, as the type of person I am, I have to do everything I feel. I do what I feel like doing, and I have been going to church, yes I have, and I have been trying to read more, and I even started reading the Bible. I think I've become a better person, because I think, I don't know how long we're going to be or whatever, no one knows, and I'm just wanting to get ready. I think it's been that way for everyone. I haven't got prepared like some people. I haven't gone to extremes with gas masks or that type of thing. I haven't done any of that. And I've done what the president said, you know, go out and this and that. I just say, hey, listen, we're going on with our life. That's the best thing we can do. I think most of the population were maybe stunned for a few days. But we know we have to keep going, and everybody has obligations and things that they have to do every day. And our president and our Congress is taking care of things. We can't do anything. We don't know enough information or anything about it. So we just have to go along with our leaders. And I voted for Bush, and I wasn't a Republican, but I'm an independent. And I'm glad that I voted for him. Just I'm hoping that everything goes all right, and I hope that the president keeps the same plan, that we have to just keep putting the pressure on him, because it's not going to go away. I don't know what else we can do. We just have to, you know, pray and hope that everything is okay. And I think it's going to be okay. Right? So I believe God is on our side.
John Puccico lives in Providence. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How is the air war over Afghanistan or the anthrax scare here in the U.S. affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.